A lot of were basically kind of pretty big failures. Some of them won't be known outside of Texas, but here they were very big deals. For example, the Trans-Texas Corridor was this proposal to build this very expensive this network of toll roads and highways that involved public-private partnerships. It was
Boris, I'm going to interrupt because I want to give Kia a chance to respond, and then we're going to continue this discussion and post online. Kia Collier, if you could talk about Rick Perry's close ties to Kelsey Warren, certainly the center of a massive national controversy around the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Right. Perry, I think, has been pretty close to Warren, both personally and professionally, for a long time. Kelsey Warren has given him a ton of money, a ton of political support. And when he stepped down as Texas governor in 2015, he was shortly thereafter appointed to the board of Energy Transfer Partners. We explored those kind of conflicts of interest, I guess, in our piece. And experts told us, he's probably going to have to step down from his board position on Energy Transfer Partners if he, is confirmed to head the Energy Department.
Well, we're going to leave it there and then do part two of this discussion and post it at democracynow.org. Kia Collier of the Texas Tribune and Forrest Wilder of the Texas Observer, thank you so much for joining us. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Ndura, Andre Lewis, Miguel Nogueira, Mike DeFilippo, and Paul Huckabee, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Rocks with Standing Rock on Thursday, December 15th at 8 p.m. at Dante's. This event will include native speakers, raffles, and live music by Spirit Lake, Miller & Sasser, Midlife Crisis, John Dutch, and more as a benefit for camps at Standing Rock. Again, that's Portland Rocks with Standing Rock on Thursday, December 15th at 8 p.m. at Dante's. Dante's is at 350 West Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found on the KBOO website, kboo.fm, on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of a board meeting in writing, please email monica@kboo.org.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, accessories, and gifts with a focus on U.S.-made and certified fair trade natural fiber clothing since 1984. Gazelle is located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at GazelleNaturalFiberClothing.com.
You can say that it's about the savages. You can say you have a better way to live. You can call it manifest destiny. You can talk of all your civilization will give. You can say that we're a thing of history, and progress is the future you will bring. You can send your armies to these mountains. You can say we'll prosper beneath your king. But there will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. 'cause our future is not yours to choose. You can say you've got to stop the communists. You can say that our ideals can't succeed. You can say that competition is the only way, and a global system based on greed. You can call yourself a Democrat. You can call yourself whatever you will. You can keep on stamping out the fires you start, so you might stay on top of the hill. But there will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have.
And good morning. Back at you with Wednesday Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. Be with you until 9 o'clock. And yes, I was out there in North Dakota at Standing Rock and got back on Saturday. And we're not going to be talking much about that. Talking about some bigger questions that I kind of been not talking about as much because of covering Standing Rock and other pressing issues. Our guest on the phone from New York this morning is Ellen Schrecker, a retired professor of American history at Yeshiva University. Schrecker is a leading authority on McCarthyism, whose books include Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism in the Universities. And we're going to be talking about a number of aspects of that. And so let me bring her up right now. Good morning, Ellen Schrecker.
Good morning to you, too.
And so, yeah, there's a, I don't know if you heard Democracy Now! This morning, but they were talking about McCarthyism specifically in relation to Russia. That's one of the aspects. And there's many others, because obviously with the new Trump administration and his cabinet picks, it's the silencing of voices on climate change, the continued pressure on university professors who speak out on all kinds of issues, a general anti-science climate. Who knows what all's going to come up? Certainly the repression seems to be destined to amp up. So we're going to be talking about a number of different aspects, but I did get back from Standing Rock. I just want to talk about that for a couple minutes. It was cold. The conditions are rather brutal out there. I believe there's a polar vortex descending on North Dakota, along with much of the rest of the northern United States. There's a lot of people have left. I don't know what the current estimates of people in camp, 600 to 1,000 people. As I mentioned when I called in last Wednesday from there, my impression is they really don't need a lot of clothing donations anymore, possibly really specialized high-tech winter gloves, like really good coats, really good snow pants. Boots, really good boots they probably have a need of. I mean, I'm talking about the high-end type items because it's really cold out there. Not just your garden variety winter clothing. Please do not send that. They're just overflowing. I don't think they've really had a chance to even inventory everything they've got that's come in. Stuff was just stacked outside all the supply tents in the snow. They're trying to tarp it as best they can. The arrival of the veterans and many convoys carrying people there that last weekend, really, 2 weekends ago, really overloaded the capacity at the camp that I think they had been developing. They've had good systems in place, but just so many people and so much stuff arriving all at once really stressed the camp out. And so I think they're really probably dealing with the fallout from that. There's a lot of different political stuff going on. There's different views on whether the camp will remain, how much of the camp will remain, who's going to be there. There are some accusations about individuals having their own sort of GoFundMe accounts and sort of diverting funds to their own personal use. I can't speak to that. There's so much going on there, so many different voices. There's people who are criticizing Chairman Archambault for possibly having cut a deal. There doesn't seem to be any evidence of that. My impression is he's really tried to walk a delicate balance between the various factions, the various groups, various tendencies, and so far done it admirably well. It could be proven wrong. What's going to happen with the new Trump administration is anybody's guess there. Right now, there doesn't seem to be any drilling going on. There's a whole, once they get the environmental impact statement process going, that takes a while. What the impact on the project is going to be is anybody's guess. I know that's kind of vague. Hopefully next week we'll have Jacqueline Keeler back on and explore all this at greater depth. So with that, Ellen Schrecker, talk about how you see this period we're entering into being somewhat analogous to the McCarthy period.
You've got it. Everybody's talking, using that M word, right? McCarthyism, is it coming back? No, this isn't it. Well, as someone who has spent, 30 years maybe working, studying, reading a lot about McCarthyism, and sort of asking myself, are we going to see a replay? Are we going to see some kind of new McCarthyism appear and bring a new political chill to the United States, as McCarthyism did in the late 1940s and 50s? And being a historian, my answer is always going to be professionally nuanced. In other words, yes and no. No, we're not going to see a return of the House Un-American Activities Committee or Joseph McCarthy or people exposing others as quote-unquote communists. Maybe they'll talk about people being, what's the term that the right uses, Islamic terrorists. But I think that's kind of peripheral, that is focus on exposure. The reason there was so much of a focus on exposure and asking people, are you now or have you ever been, was because McCarthyism was very specific in its focus, in its goals. What it wanted to do was eliminate the influence of American communism in American life, in American politics, in American society. And it was very successful, but it was very focused on a party that did have ties to the Soviet Union, that's true, but it was legal. And the reason it was so vulnerable was it was also secret. And so as a result, exposure was the method, the instrument of sort of sanctions that was used. That's not going to happen. What I think will happen is may very well be worse, because it's going to be very diffuse and it has the power of the American government, the federal government behind it, when we've got a president-to-be talking about depriving quote-unquote flag burners of their citizenship. We're talking about very serious moves toward political repression and toward the suppression of dissenting opinions. What I see today, for example, is that the election of Trump has unleashed a kind of whole barrage of right-wing attacks, not just on the left. The left has always been under attack, but on liberals and on the mainstream. And that's very scary. A lot of it comes in the form, for example, I know within American universities today, all of a sudden a website popped up called the Professor Watch List. I don't know, Paul, if you've heard about this or not.
I think on the phone with you last night, actually.
Yeah. Well, it's a list of about 160 professors who have, quote-unquote, and I forget the exact wording of this, talked in their classes in ways that, quote-unquote, seem to have offended conservative students. And this list is pretty scary because it's very random. It's conservative students who may not be A students by any means, who misunderstand what their professors are saying, send in a report to this quote-unquote watch list, which then gets put on the web, and it's beginning to affect people's careers. This is very scary, because what made McCarthyism function in the 1940s and 50s was not so much people being named, but the fact that once you were named, once you were exposed, then you were punished. And the punishments, the sanctions that were imposed during the McCarthy period were usually economic. They weren't necessarily criminal sanctions. In other words, people did go to jail, but it was only a few hundred people, maybe. Open members of the Communist Party, people who were caught doing illegal things. We know two people were executed, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. But the vast majority of what we would call the victims of McCarthyism were people who lost their jobs after they went before a congressional committee and refused to cooperate, or they lost their jobs after the FBI showed up in the office of the university president, for example, and handed him what was called a blind memorandum, just a list of that professor's affiliation with a variety of left-wing organizations. And that could trigger somebody's dismissal and future blacklisting and destroy careers. And it happened over and over and over again. We don't know how many people it happened to. This is because people kept it secret. Obviously, they wanted to keep their jobs, and they didn't talk about this if they got themselves a new job. But these economic sanctions function mainly because private employers were willing to buy into this notion that somebody who had once been a communist, and many of the people who were targeted during the McCarthy period had in fact belonged to a communist organization of one kind or another, maybe when they were students in the 1930s, but they left it once the Cold War began. These are a number of former communists, people who were no longer very politically active. But what the committees did was provoke these people by saying, are you now or have you ever been in the Communist Party? And then if somebody answered that question, said, yes, but I left in 1948, the committees will say, well, who else was in the party with you? And most of these people were still liberal, were still more or less on the left, even if they were no longer activists, but they certainly didn't want to become informers. They did not want to get other people in trouble. And so they refused to cooperate with the committees. And once that happened, their employers sort of automatically assumed that they were tainted, that keeping them on the payroll would risk the credibility of the organization. They might lose their clients, who knows what. And so they fired them. And this is what made McCarthyism so powerful, was the collaboration of employers and other mainstream institutions, including other branches of the government, including the Supreme Court, going along with a very radical anti-communist movement that was determined to essentially destroy the American left. And it was amazingly successful. And we can't let that happen again today.
So you brought up a lot of things. So in one thing, I mean, obviously not the people, friends of, acquaintances of people who were targeted, specifically targeted. I mean, you had members of the Communist Party, you had ex-members of the Communist Party, then you had their family members, their friends, their associates, their business associates, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so people would go after those people to try to name names as well. And some of them collaborated, some of them didn't. But so one of the things that happened was a wedge was often driven. So people would like not just lose their job, they would potentially lose friends, might get estranged from family members. And it just had a general chilling effect on politics and political discourse, and kind of drove a wedge between, you know, the, I don't know if it has ever really fully recovered, the affiliation or alliance or whatever between quote liberals and quote radicals that occurred at that time, that, you know, Chris Hedges has written immensely about, the sort of the failure of the liberal left. And my reading is, and I think to some extent his too, is that certain amount of that comes out of the sort of the ending of sort of a more fertile interchange of ideas, sort of the hardening of the liberal ideas and the hardening of the radical ideas, sort of the separation. And this is kind of a complicated subject, but anyway.
I think you're completely right. One of the things, I did a lot of interviews, especially for my first book about McCarthyism in the universities, and I had many, many people tell me about friends who would cross the street rather than say hello to them, about all of a sudden being shut out, even very establishment individuals being shut out from their usual publications. A number of people, for example, in Chinese studies, which was very targeted by the witch hunt during the McCarthy period, and many very respectable academic figures who used to write book reviews for the New York Times, 10 book reviews a year or something, all of a sudden, their phone calls wouldn't be answered. So you're seeing people being shut out of a national debate, and the national debate narrowing enormously, so that subjects like, quote-unquote, socialized medicine, something today that at least we can still talk about, even though it's about to disappear, really was not allowed to be discussed in respectable quarters.
And so let me just give out the phone number. It's 822 here on Wednesday Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. I'm speaking with Ellen Schrecker, who's a longtime student and a writer about, student of and writer about the McCarthy period. And we're talking about parallels to the current situation, and sort of generally how an understanding of the McCarthy period might inform or not what's unfolding before us right now. So the number is 503-231-8187. And, just one thing to get back to the professor watch list. We know that's that's been going on, arguably ever since McCarthyism. There's been this sort of culture war that sort of has been around for decades, if not since the founding of the Republic. But the whole idea of, there's you can pick out any number of individual instances where people have been targeted, whether it's a Ward Churchill or Professor Saida at Indiana, I believe.
And, Illinois.
Illinois, sorry. And numerous others who have either, actually lost their position or had to fight like hell to keep their position. And, you know, people like David Horowitz, you know, he put out similar lists, you know, probably a couple decades ago. So that's, it's been in the, been around for a while, but where you're, what we're seeing now is the possibility that these ideas, these tendencies that have been around from the more extreme elements of the right wing, that they're sort of able to take off their gloves now, and under the sort of the soon to be Trump administration, they're going to possibly have a lot easier time gaining traction. So that seems to be one of the main dangers. And then, you know, look at he immediately asked for all the people in the Department of Energy who had been studying climate change, stuff like that. You can see signs all over that there's going to be this general clampdown on freedom of research and thought.
Exactly. And it's really actually quite terrifying, and it's beginning to have an impact. I mean, the professor's watch list, I went on it just to see what kinds of people they had targeted. Most of them I'd never heard of. Some of the very obvious names, like Noam Chomsky, are not on that list. Well, maybe that's because he's retired and isn't teaching. But a number of other people I know who are quite radical were not on there. So it's very random, and it's targeting people who oppose the concealed carry on campus law in Texas, or people who were concerned, again, climate change is certainly a big one. But also the issue that has been the sort of cutting edge for academic freedom cases in the past few years, that of Israel and Palestine, there are a number of professors there who've been involved. And you sort of track back the links, and many of them go right straight to David Horowitz and his, you know, 101 professors who he listed, at most of them having taken positions that diverge from the current Israeli official line. So what we're seeing, however, is that at least in one case that I sort of Googled and traced through, a guy was videotaped by a student in his class giving a political speech. It was clearly hostile to the Republican Party, but nonetheless, you know, it was within his jurisdiction as a professor. He was teaching a course on sort of political culture, I think. And this went, became one of these sort of viral YouTube thingies, got to the university, and the administration suspended the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is serious, and it's much more serious than McCarthyism, in that during the McCarthy period, there was no attempt to attack people for what they were doing in their classes. People were being attacked because of their past political activities and their past political affiliations, but not because of their teaching. And what's happening now is much more chilling, because now it's focusing on what you're doing in class. And you can imagine, even during the McCarthy period, when there was very little pushback, believe me, there was very little pushback, one of the few areas in which there was pushback was when the House Un-American Activities Committee sent letters to college college presidents asking for them to submit reading lists from their faculty's classes, and the professors, all said, no, forget about that one. But that could happen now. I'm sure that there are plenty of people who would love to have reading lists and sort of create blacklists from that.
Well, we've got a couple callers. Oh, go ahead. Finish your thought.
So anyhow, this seems to be a greater danger even than during the McCarthy period, because it's focusing directly on intellectual freedom, on free speech, on the circulation of ideas and the search for truth.
Well, let's go to our first caller. David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. So I'm certainly concerned that McCarthyism, as it were, may be returning in the realms you describe. It strikes me that, however, we already live in a sort of various versions of a McCarthyism. Everything from Ward Churchill being fired and having to legally fight to reinstate himself over his remarks, to Professor Stephen Jones, a physics professor who has stated that the buildings in New York at 9/11, including Building 7, of course, which wasn't even hit by a plane, could not possibly have collapsed due to the fires that are supposed to have caused that. He was fired from his university. In other fronts, well, what first Greg Palast can't seem to get on the corporate media. I mean, that's not exactly, you know, the McCarthyism in the academia, but it's various people whose views are not a non grata to sort of the Democratic, Republican, wealthy publishing, corporate, whatever, cabal. I mean, those people can't get an article in the New York Review of Books, regardless. You know, I don't know if Ward Churchill's ever been in there, but I certainly doubt that David Ray Griffith, who has written many incisive works about 9/11, I doubt that any of them have been covered in the New York Times. And in fact, everything he's written has been published by, not one of the corporate affiliated presses.
Right. Well, there's sort of a background level. What you're sort of pointing to is there's just sort of this background level of dominant society that tends to marginalize and suppress. So I guess that's one distinction that has to be made. Whereas, you know, in some sense, so something like McCarthyism is sort of an amped up, you know.
I agree. I'd hope it doesn't get worse in the ways you're describing, but I think it's worth noting that we currently live in a very limited realm of discourse already when it comes to speaking about secret lies, secret programs like 9/11 and lies that are told about it. That is very much suppressed, for example. But also Ward Churchill, speaking out. Jill Stein is arrested for even going on campus in 2012 where one of the debates was being held. I mean, people are being suppressed quite severely, and that's not spoken, not talked about much. So, except
well,
on places like Cable.
I think you're pointing to something that has been happening all along, and not necessarily with 9/11. I'm not au courant with that. But certainly on American campuses, there's been a real problem with holding a broad debate over the issue of Israel and Palestine.
Yes.
That's the area in which we're seeing these highly public cases, Stephen Salida, Norman Markowitz, a whole bunch of, not Markowitz, what's his name? People being fired, losing their jobs for taking positions that don't accord with the policy of the current Israeli government. And I think this is a kind of precursor, because what it's showing and what scares me is that in those cases, the administrations and often fellow faculty members are collaborating with these attacks on dissenting professors. And that's what's scary. And that's what was wrong with the McCarthy period, was that during that period, political organizations like the ACLU, like the American Association of University Professors collaborated. They refused to defend people who were being accused of communism. And that kind of collaboration is very seriously undermine American freedom. And what we have to focus on is supplying backbone to university presidents when a member of their faculty is accused of something by the professor watch list, and making sure that those presidents and those boards of trustees stand up and say, this is ridiculous. We believe in academic freedom and we believe in free speech, and we simply are not going to pay any attention and we're not going to investigate. And if you're really concerned about it, you know, write a book.
Well, thank you for calling, David.
Oh, thank you.
And let's go to our next caller. Camilo, you're on the air. Hello?
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hello? Are you hearing me now?
Yeah, we've been hearing you. Go ahead.
Okay, my name is Camilo Marquez. I happen to be familiar with this subject because I'm the ex-husband of Margaret Fuchs Singer, author of Legacy of a False Promise, which is about the ordeal her family went through after her father, Herbert Fuchs, who was a communist, named names, and still lost his job because of the failure of the university to protect him.
Yeah, I know the case.
I'm sure that you would have been familiar with that. But you anticipated the question that I had, which was about the issue of the treatment that people who are addressing the issue about Israel and Palestine. And if I remember correctly, I understand that this idea of their being labeled as anti-Semites is even being considered as a kind of terrorism.
Yeah. What's scary is that we're also seeing, I think there's a law out there that is now adopting a official definition of anti-Semitism that includes criticism of Israel, the Israeli issue, and support for the BDS movement. And that seems to me to be really scary because it is expanding sanctions into an area that is clearly still debatable and needs to be debated, an area that is, you know, the fact is that violations of freedom of speech and academic freedom occur on the edges. They're not hitting the mainstream. They're hitting people who are doing something that's unpopular. And apparently today, people who support the Palestinian position on BDS, for example, are now vulnerable. And that's what's scary.
Yes. Well, that's the subject I was interested in hearing you discuss. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you for calling, Camilo. And the number again is 503-231-8187. It's 8:37, so you better get your calls in. Don't wait till the last 5 minutes. It usually doesn't work so well. So, you know, this idea of collaboration, this is really where I personally wanted to go with this conversation. You know, Cornel West was on Democracy Now! Last week, and he's the first person that I had heard, like, on a, you know, nationally broadcast media outlet, openly talking about the Trump regime being a neo-fascist takeover of an already corrupt and exploitative political and economic system. Already, there was already basically a corporate takeover of the political system that has been in effect for decades, and this is sort of just an acceleration of that from my reading. And he called it openly neo-fascist. So, you know, when you put together, I mean, the fundamental difference between McCarthy and Trump is that Trump was elected president and McCarthy ended up, you know, basically being censured and marginalized after he wrought immense damage. He and, you know, it wasn't just him, it was him and his other political and business allies or whatever, you know, the sort of the conservative element.
Network.
Yeah. There you go. And the conservative network after the 60s challenge to it kind of regained their strength, regrouped, and got all these think tanks and you know, the whole neocon movement, et cetera. And we could go into all that. But the danger is that, you know, it is something like a corporate fascist takeover of the further takeover of the institutional framework and the, you know, whatever, you know, the danger of fascism is that whatever protection that the rule of law, however contradictory and weak that might be, kind of gets swept away. So collaborators in that situation, as, you know, I know from my reading, my father was somewhat in the Italian resistance. I've always been fascinated by the World War II resistance movements. You know, the term collaborator was those who collaborated with the Nazis or a fascist. And you know, there's something very obviously similar to that in the McCarthy period, in that, you know, you had people collaborating with the House Un-American activities. So the whole the point that we were talking when we talked to last night was this liberal radical alliance, fragile in the best of times and oh so easy to break, because people being afraid for their economic position, being afraid for their social position, being afraid for their emotional psychological position, who knows, tend to shy away from taking strong stands on behalf of what you're calling, you know, unpopular or marginalized people and positions. So that's the admonishment I want to make here in Portland, Oregon, or wherever people are, is that we need to keep those channels open and keep that alliance going.
Exactly. And we need to, because what happened during the McCarthy period was just about everybody collaborated, that the opposition to what was going on was incredibly marginalized. And all of the main institutions of American society, public and private, went along with the witch hunt on the grounds that there was something illegitimate about communism, and therefore any individual, any institution, any ideas associated with communism in one way or another were illegitimate and could be evicted from American society. And what may have what have we learned from McCarthyism? And I hope that that's the main lesson we've learned, that we have to maintain solidarity. And I want to point to one encouraging sign that I've seen just recently, which is an organization I used to work with, the American Association of University Professors, which is the main organization devoted, among other things, to the defense of academic freedom. In the 1950s, was totally absent. They didn't do a thing. Over 100 professors were fired, some very publicly, and the AAUP was missing, simply missing, for a whole bunch of reasons, but one of them was a kind of political cowardice. Just recently, the AAUP has decided to respond to this professors' watch list by circulating a petition to its members and supporters, inviting them to send their names to the Professor Watch List website and say, put me on your list. And already several thousand people have signed on. I certainly did when I saw it. In a sense, it's a throwback or an attempt to imitate the behavior during the Nazi period when the Germans invaded Denmark and demanded that Danish Jews begin to wear the yellow star, and the King of Denmark stood up and said, I too will wear a star. And we're hearing a lot of people talking about supporting Muslims. if there's going to be registration of Muslims, all kinds of Jews and atheists and Catholics and you name it are going to sign that list and say, yes, we too are Muslims. So there is an attempt among certain groups to push back and to maintain solidarity, and that has to be emphasized because we can't really get anywhere unless there's a recognition that we need to all work together and that we can't separate over smaller issues. That the big issue here is the ability to have free speech, the ability to dissent from what's going on, and we're going to have a lot of things that we need to dissent about.
And of course, you know, McCarthyism, the period you're talking about, it overlapped with the period where the United States was still formally cooperating with the Soviet Union. But of course, there is people who didn't like that to begin with, and certainly the U.S. elements of the U.S. were already gearing up to get rid of, discard that alliance as soon as the war was over. And of course, the, you know, anti-communism, anti-radical goes back way further. Obviously, the Red Scares. Yeah. Of the 1920 and 1921, which in some ways parallels what's going on now too, because the strident anti-immigrant nativist rhetoric and action that was going on then, but the whole development of McCarthyism and the whole kind of disruption of what had sort of come to be in reality and was termed the Popular Front. It was, I guess, the United Front was sort of, I learned this recently, was the United Front was sort of the communists sort of being the front and everybody else sort of, them trying to get everybody else on the bandwagon, whereas the Popular Front idea was more like really everybody kind of working together, liberals, radicals, libertarians, principal conservatives, you name it, to confront a common threat. So it seems like what we're going to have to do is actually come together in some kind of popular front. And the difficulties are to get over the ideological contradictions and tensions that we've never really fully dealt with. I don't know if this is a question that you've tackled yourself, but it bedevils me constantly, having spent some time in Italy, just to, even amongst the so-called self-proclaimed radicals, the anarchists and the extra-parliamentary left, the communists or socialists there who never could get along and never had any real conversations with each other. The lack of actual political discourse, even across various radical traditions and tendencies, let alone, across the radical liberal divide, let alone trying to define what those things are, I find miserably lacking. I don't know there in New York how it is.
Yeah, I think I agree with you in that. I think we also need to look back on our own history. And there were periods when there was a sense of unity, a kind of coalition. I'm thinking here of the civil rights movement. I'm thinking here of the anti-war movement during the 1960s and early 70s. There were moments when people realized that there were issues that were so central to American political life that these kind of minor, and they're not minor, but these disagreements over ideology had to be submerged in order to create some kind of broader democratic movement. And we have to really think very seriously about what our priorities are. And I think the main priority has got to be to allow for freedom of speech and freedom of dissent, and that we can't be involved and sort of say, well, I'm only going to defend transgender rights and immigrants will have to deal with their own issues. We have to deal with everybody's issue. And the underlying issue that we have to deal with is to ensure that freedom remains. And I think, you know, you use the word neo-fascism. I'm not sure I'm there yet. But certainly the key issue of fascism was an attack on political freedom. And we have to really, really keep that in mind at every moment, that political freedom is what we have to defend, and it is under attack.
So the number again is 503-231-8187. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the regular host, Paul Roland, and I'm speaking with Ellen Schrecker, who's been studying and writing about McCarthyism for quite a long time, retired professor of American history at Yeshiva University. She's written books including Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism in the Universities. So since we've got 10 minutes left and we haven't had callers, you know, the Democracy Now! Was just ended here at 8 o'clock on KABU. They were talking a lot about McCarthyism also in the context of the, you know, these fake news sites and the whether or not Russia was behind these email hacks in relation to the election of Donald Trump, this vast questions that are difficult at best to pronounce upon because the CIA actually is not providing their hard evidence. They've got this report based upon secret information. But anyway, so that the whole idea of these fake news sites, which are a real problem, obviously, because that's the thing. There's such ambiguity in the increasing ambiguity with the increasing power of the internet and diffusion of multiple sources of information and the ease of planting fake information through these sites and the vast economic and political interests that there are in manipulating news and information. It's a minefield to navigate. But so the question of, you know, was Russia behind it? And then, you know, the targeting of people who are questioning that narrative does seem to me to fall under this broad sort of generic idea of McCarthyism, sort of separated from the specific historical context of Joseph McCarthy at the time. But so I don't know if you want to respond to this. I just want to read this quote from Jeffrey St. Clair, who's kind of the one of the originators of the Counterpunch website, which is one of my favorites, and certainly has been tackling a lot of these issues. So he says, what if the real Russian plot was to plant the idea that Russia had hacked the vote, thereby sending panic through the nation, launching investigations that devolve into wild goose chases, pitting intelligence agencies against each other? Very provocative statement. I don't know. You have anything to respond about that general question?
Well, it seems to me that, you know, when I'm looking at what's similar and what's different between McCarthyism way back when and today, the internet has complicated the issue enormously. And I think you've pointed that out, that this is the overload of information is just so overwhelming that it's seeking, in a sense, to depoliticize politics. I think what we're seeing is a way of depriving ordinary citizens of a measure of agency, of a way of even responding to what's going on, whether or not whatever Russia has been doing. And I think that's what's kind of scary, is that when you are being so manipulated and you don't know what's true and what isn't true, you're going to withdraw. You're going to stop being political. You're going to give up because you're going to feel totally unable to cope. I mean, at this point, I feel, well, in order to understand what's going on, I think I need to be on the internet 24 hours a day. You know, and I need to have a life as well. But I think that this is what's so dangerous, is that it's going to contribute even more than everything we've seen in the past to a withdrawal and a passivity on the part of the American public that is going to allow this really dangerous right-wing agenda to continue without any opposition.
And I think there can... Well, I think there's an argument that, you know, there's something about the Weimar culture, the Weimar Republic, that was a certain escapism and withdrawal. And what you're pointing to in the current oversaturated, the vast expansion of the technosphere and the entertainment sphere and everything else is just adds more ability to feeds that tendency even more.
I think so, although I would argue, you know, the Weimar issue, I don't think is because of the quote-unquote decadent culture of Berlin. I think that's, again, almost a diversion that's going to feed into the notion of, well, if we, you know, Americans are so concerned, or certain liberal groups are so concerned about LGBT issues, that they're undermining American society. I don't think that's the issue.
Well, I certainly wasn't going in that direction.
Yeah, but I don't think those are the kinds of things that are a problem so much as the encouragement of passivity.
Well, listen, we got one more caller. Let's squeeze Jack in. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I heard early on in the conversation that already some harm is being done to some academics. And is there, can you cite something?
Is there any what?
Well, you mentioned that that there will be some damage to
specific examples. He's asking
some academics are already suffering some kind of repercussions because of the restrictions, the McCarthyism, what we see now. And you said already this is happening. And could you cite some example?
Yeah, I went on the professor watch list, and one name jumped out at me because it's a name that, as a somebody who grew up in Philadelphia, is very familiar with. It was William Penn. So I looked up William Penn. I Googled it. He's a professor of, I think it's English composition at Michigan State. A student had videotaped a lesson of his and then posted it on website, and it went viral. And the administration at Michigan State, a major university, took him out of the classroom.
Did they fire him or just change, give him a different assignment?
A different assignment, but whatever they're going to do, you know, they're going to investigate, but whatever they're going to do, that is illegitimate. They shouldn't have responded in any way, shape, or form. And, in fact, the student, who I think remains anonymous, as he jolly well should be, because I think he's probably broken several laws and certainly could be sued for a violation of intellectual freedom for videotaping a professor and then posting it online. That is stealing that professor's intellectual property.
Understood. Have you heard of Nicholas Drapella from the Oregon State University?
No.
Okay. In 2012, I believe it was, Nicholas Drapella was fired summarily and given no reason. And they never did give a reason for firing him. Very successful professor, published several books plus lots of papers, and students liked him and everything. And he finally had to conclude that the only reason he was fired is because he was an outspoken critic of anthropogenic global warming theory. And so this is going every this is going on every direction if you follow my drift.
Well, that's a separate question because actually the academic freedom to teach invalid science is may not be actually an academic freedom. The question of anthropogenic global warming is well established in the scientific literature.
This is relevant.
It's
science, and people have different opinions.
No. Well, we're at the end of the
guy just because of his position on scientific theory. Then I think that
This is a question that's impossible to actually get into deeply. At the very end, we only have 30 seconds left. Thank you so much, Ellen Schrecker. Sorry, we had to end on a somewhat confusing.
I would say is that in this particular case, which I don't know anything about, the issue is whether what he was teaching. In other words, is he teaching physics, where this is not a matter of academic freedom, but professional expertise?
Okay, we got to leave. We're at the end of the hour. Thank you so much. We got to go. This is Paul Rowan, Wednesday Talk Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Buyer and Seller, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from November 25th through December 17th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Buyer and Seller, the story of an underemployed Los Angeles actor who goes to work in Barbara Streisand's Malibu, California basement, allowing for delicious wit and commentary on the solitude of celebrity, the love-hate attraction between gay men and divas, and the melancholy that lurks beneath narcissism. Again, that's Buyer and Seller, November 25th through December 17th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.